You're listening to NewYorkTalkRadio.net.
Stay tuned for Steal This Radio with Mitchell Cohen.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Welcome to Steal This Radio. This is Mitchell Cohen here in the studio in scenic Tribeca with Mickey Z in from Astoria. Hey, Mickey.
Hey, Mitch. Thanks for having me. Most people, when they begin a speech, implore the audience to turn off their cell phones. But those familiar with my work know I do quite the opposite. I urge you to leave them on. And in the name of explaining why, it is a nice introduction to a talk about animal rights. I ask you to leave your cell phones on because every time one of your cell phones rings, we can contemplate the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We would do that because one of the primary components of cell phone circuitry is a metallic ore called columbite tantalite, aka coltan, most of which is found in the African nation of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which just so happens to be embroiled in a particularly brutal war for more than a decade. And when I say particularly brutal, I mean even by today's insane standards. Now, both sides in this civil war are using child labor to mine and sell coltan to fund their military mayhem and feed our cell phone addictions. And there's more. The world's largest primate, the eastern lowland gorilla, has as its primary habitat the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in particular where the coltan is found. So I probably don't have to tell you what's being done to the world's largest primate in the name of using child labor to fund a civil war and feed our cell phone addictions. But I could sum it up in one little factoid. In the past 5 years, the population of the eastern lowland gorilla has declined by 90%. We can only hope that some clever entrepreneur has recorded the cry of the eastern lowland gorilla so long after it's gone extinct we could use that cry as a ringtone. So go ahead, leave your cell phones on. I'm going to begin with a quote from the book or the movie, Grapes of Wrath, spoken by the lead character Tom Joad. And Tom said, "Maybe we're not all individual souls, but maybe we're all part of one big soul." Incredibly basic, I know, but within this simplicity lies what I believe to be the secret. For if we were to look upon all living things, including ourselves, as part of one collective soul, how could we not defend this collective soul by any means necessary? And what do I mean by collective soul? To understand this requires us to make connections that in general aren't being made even on the left, connections I touched on in the cell phone intro, and here's another example. Let's say a jaguar, a rapidly disappearing species in Central or South America, its habitat stolen by the progress of Homo sapiens, creeps onto a farm to kill and eat a cow to survive. The response will be predictable. Human beings will be united in outrage. The jaguar will be called a pest, and it will be promptly hunted down and shot without either contemplation or penalty. After all, we can't let one of those beasts kill one of our beasts, can we? No, that's our job. And it's also our job to destroy the rainforest so that cow has room to get fat in the first place. And it's our job to slaughter the cow, eat it, and get fat ourselves. And perhaps most importantly, it's our job to pretend we have absolutely nothing to do with this destructive cycle, this destructive culture. Pretend we have nothing to do with the millions of animals tortured and murdered in laboratories each year, the millions of animals tortured and murdered for fur each year, the billions of animals tortured and murdered for food each year. It all comes down to perceptions. Perceptions shape our reality. Particularly on the left, issues of political and social issues are shaped by our perceptions. My perception is this: we need a far more holistic view of radical activism, but the connections are not being made, not even by those on the left. Cornel West, a renowned leftist, did his best to try and define what it meant to be a leftist, and here's what he said in part. Quote, "If you are concerned about structural violence, if you are concerned about exploitation at the workplace, if you're concerned about institutionalized contempt against gay brothers and lesbian sisters, if you're concerned about organized hatred against peoples of color, if you're concerned about the subordination of women, that's not cheap PC chit-chat. That is a calling that you're willing to fight against and try to understand the sources of that social misery at the structural and institutional level and at the existential and the personal level. That's what it means, in part, to be a leftist." Close quote. Now, of course, he said, in part, but it's interesting to note that someone could talk about the structural, institutional, existential, and personal levels and not even mention the following words: environment, land base, ecosystem, extinction, or animals. But this is typical of how vegan issues and animal rights issues are treated across the spectrum. And on the left, it's a bit of a stepchild. Despite the fact that issues around veganism and animal rights involve health issues, ethical issues, environmental issues, and issues involving corporate welfare, workers' rights, torture, freedom, equality, and justice, it remains ignored for the most part by the left. In fact, across the spectrum, it is treated like a stepchild. For example, on the right wing or the mainstream, or perhaps I'm being redundant, those who actively pursue animal rights activism, vegan activism, or dark green eco-activism are commonly called terrorists, which makes me wonder, how does one qualify as a terrorist in 2010 America? By current standards, you could pack a calf into a veal crate, or pump food down a goose's gullet, or blind and dissect a monkey, or grind up live male chicks to fertilize your fields and run no risk of being called a terrorist. For that matter, you could clear-cut forests, blow off mountaintops in search of coal, drag trawling nets across the ocean floor, and you'd garner virtually no attention at all, let alone be called a terrorist. But if you choose a lifestyle of compassion and logic, speak out against vivisection, or protest the use of fur, you, says the mainstream and the right, deserve an orange jumpsuit and a one-way ticket to Guantanamo. Literally. Consider the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act of 2006, otherwise known as the AETA, which specifically targets anyone who, quote, "intentionally damages or causes the loss of any real or personal property, including animals or records, used by animal enterprise." And then it goes further. "Or any real or personal property of a person or entity having a connection to, relationship with, or transactions with an animal enterprise." Close quote. Pretty broad brush there. Now, I can't help it. I spent 12 years in Catholic school, and every time I quote from the AETA, I have to juxtapose it with another quote, this one from the book of John, chapter 2, verses 13 to 16, which reads as follows. "In the temple courts, Jesus found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at the table exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, 'Get out of here.'" So I suggest the next time you're faced with that common question, what would Jesus do? Thanks to the AETA, you can now confidently answer 12 to 18 months. Which brings us to the left, which just doesn't or won't get it on this issue. And when I say left, I am going with a pretty broad brush myself, because I'm even including Al Gore, who by any sane definition is not a leftist, but in an insane society is commonly called a dangerous socialist. He is also perhaps the world's most famous environmentalist, which then makes it even more inexcusable that he chooses to ignore the role of the meat-based diet in climate change. A recent World Watch Institute report found that 51% of human-caused greenhouse gases comes from the industrial meat-based diet. Yet, in a conversation with the musician Moby, he said it was, quote, too inconvenient for most people, close quote, to reduce meat consumption. He used the word inconvenient. In a recent New York Times op-ed called We Can't Wish Away Climate Change, he spent nearly 2,000 words ignoring the meat-based diet. In fact, I did a word search over those 2,000 words, and none of the following terms were found: meat, cow, livestock, methane, farm, diet, or vegan. But again, this shouldn't be too surprising. This is the man who sponsored the Live Earth concerts 3 years ago to raise awareness about climate change. And at those concerts, they served burgers and hot dogs. So with his massive audience and huge amount of influence, he chose to miss an opportunity to educate, to inform, and to inspire real change. Now, what about the more serious left? Let's say someone like Michael Albert, the co-founder of Z Magazine and ZNet website, a man with nearly five decades of activist credibility and a long association with Noam Chomsky, which has lent him even more credibility on the left. What is he doing with all this credibility and influence on this issue? Well, here's a quote from his memoir.
I see no comparison in importance between seeking to eliminate the roots and branches of sexism and seeking to eliminate the roots and branches of violence against animals. I see no comparison in importance between how chickens are treated and how women or any humans are treated. In fact, for me, the animal rights agenda resonates barely at all, and the anti-sexism agenda is part of my life.
Thus, in one paragraph, he is reaching out to his audience to legitimize his own personal myopia and a concept of single-issueism. Now, moving a little bit further to the left, although he'd probably cringe at being called a leftist, I give you Ward Churchill, the American Indian scholar and activist, a man I typically would write of with some admiration. And after his controversy, the essay he wrote after 9/11, I wrote constantly to defend his right for what he said, and he even thanked me publicly for it. But I will take him to task when he writes stuff like this.
For most people in the anarchist community who organize in their little collectives and get together and eat their bean sprouts and shit, it's only for themselves at the present time. If you want to talk to factory workers, you need to get over your prohibition on ashtrays. Get over your bicycles and go down and bend a wrench with a gearhead for a while. Do what he's fucking doing.
Close quote. So instead of reaching out to his audience with a holistic view of radical activism, like Michael Albert, he is focusing on his personal biases and myopia and refusing to see the larger picture, what I call the collective soul. In fact, by saying do what he's fucking doing, he's promoting the stereotype that real men fix cars and smoke cigarettes while wimps ride bicycles and eat bean sprouts. So my message to Ward Churchill, to Michael Albert, to Al Gore, and to anyone on the left who chooses to ignore our collective soul is this. With 80% of the world's forests cut down, 90% of the large fish in the ocean gone, 100 plant or animal species going extinct every single day, and our ecosystem rapidly approaching the point of no return, there's never been a more urgent time to be such a wimp. In the face of such a global crisis, the left chooses to ignore our collective soul. Like the bull in a bullfight, the left focuses on the elusive red cape instead of the matador, distracted from real targets by the attractive illusion. But take heart, some bulls see through the red cape bullshit. Quite justifiably, they will introduce the matador to the business end of their mighty horns. Of course, as things stand now, those bulls are promptly killed while the matador is mourned as a brave hero. But here's a question. If every single bull in every single bullfight were to gore every single matador, how long would it be before bullfights are a thing of the past? It comes down to the connections I was talking about before, and I'll give you one more example before I close. This is a little something I like to call slavery, a capitalist parable. In the most remote regions of Brazil, slave labor is employed to cut down grand swaths of the precious rainforest to make room to grow eucalyptus, which is then burned by male slaves, who exploit the body, mind, and spirit of female slaves forced into prostitution. The male slaves make charcoal for the steel mills of Brazil, where the poorest of the poor toil for wages that do not sustain them, so that steel can then be shipped to a General Motors plant in Mexico. GM is the second largest employer south of the border. Mexico, where the poorest of the poor suffer sweatshop conditions, so those automobile parts can then be shipped to a GM plant in the U.S. Roughly 50% of what we call trade consists of business transactions between branches of the same multinational corporation. The United States, where even the poorest of the poor proudly take on imposing debt to possess a car made in the USA so they can clog the highways that were paved over countless ecosystems, filling the air with noxious pollution as they make their way to the drive-through window of an anti-union fast food restaurant that purchased the beef of slaughtered cattle that once grazed on land cleared by male slaves who exploited the body, mind, and spirit of female slaves in the most remote regions of Brazil. Now, I opened up with a soul-related quote, and I will close with a soul-related quote, this one roughly 45 years old from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "One day, the absurdity of the almost universal human belief in the slavery of other animals will be palpable. We shall then have discovered our souls and become worthier of sharing this planet with them."
And that was Mickey Z in a talk that he gave at the Left Forum a couple of weeks ago here in New York City, and today live in our studios. And we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Steal This Radio. Mitchell Cohn here in the studio with Mickey Z. Why don't you describe some of your writings, and then we'll get back into the talk that you just gave.
Yeah, it's 9 and counting, with number 10 on the way this year. And I'm happy to say that 3 of those 10 now are fiction. So that's a long time dream. I think many writers begin telling stories and picture themselves as a novelist or a fiction writer. As I became more aware and more radicalized, that was the venue in which my writing was first accepted. So the first book is now 10 years ago, was Alternative History of World War II. And I've covered a lot of ground since then. But I think the common theme of my writing is just sort of challenging commonly held myths and encouraging people to think for themselves.
Well, I was at your talk at the Left Forum, the one that you just offered us here, and it was riveting. You're on a panel with other really interesting folks.
It's an interesting story because it started actually at the Veggie Pride Parade last year, an annual event here in New York City, modeled on the Gay Pride Parade, but for vegetarians and vegans and people, sympathizers, shall I say. And I gave a talk there, and when I got off the stage, a gentleman named Camille Gossal said to me he would love to put together a panel the following year at the Left Forum, and to his credit, he followed through. And he asked me to be involved along with Gary Null, John Sambomatsu, and Pamela Rice, who is the organizer of the Veggie Pride Parade. And I thought it was a great mix of people. And I must say, it was absolutely a pleasure to see how many people were at the panel, how involved they were, how they were interested in the talk, asking really riveting questions. And it was a wonderful experience.
Well, we hardly ever at the Left Forum have anything at all about animal rights or species rights, the whole question of rights for non-humans. I know that in the Bolivia Constitution, they just passed, as part of it, a whole section on the rights of the earth. And that's the first time that that's been part of any kind of legal document by a nation state. So what do you mean by rights of animals or other species?
Well, as I mentioned in the talk, what's interesting to me is that issues surrounding animal rights and vegan issues and vegetarian issues touch on so many issues that are close to the hearts of the leftists: environmentalism, justice, freedom, workers' rights, corporate welfare, and so on. But it seems like they stop when it comes to discussing the ecosystem or animals. I can't really understand the ecosystem part. I would like to believe that environmentalism crosses all ideological boundaries, because regardless of what your ideology is, your biology remains the same. What I've faced myself throughout the years is common retorts like, "I'm too busy dealing with human issues. I can't take any time away to do animal rights. It's a distraction from the important issues." And that's why I was really excited to have the opportunity to reach that audience. So I try my best to do it. Actually, I don't use the word rights a whole lot because it's sort of a hot button word. I try to just present a more holistic view and impart to the audience that we're all in this together. And when I talk about the collective soul, I'm not just trying to be poetic. I really mean those words when I say it, because we live on this planet. I often hear people say to me, hey, you live your way and I'll live mine and the planet's going to do what it's going to do. But the life that we've chosen as human beings is taking away 100 animal and plant species a day in terms of extinction. We're taking a lot of species with us. So it's not just a personal choice. It's a global choice, how we choose to live. And that's really the focus of what I'm getting at here.
I was just reading on the train on the way here, monthly review this month from March 2010. There's a really incredible article that'll depress everybody by Fred Magdoff and John Bellamy Foster called What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism. And it documents point by point by point the horrible things that are happening and how the system itself is implicated in this destruction that's happening. We're in a system that's based on grow or die. Whole islands, something like 800 million people live within 5 meters of the water level, and they're going to be wiped out. And we're talking about the places where 800 million people live, islands, Manhattan, parts of Brooklyn where I live.
I hate to allow myself to think this, but I often wonder if that's what it'll take before people wake up, because it has to be that tangible. It has to be the water lapping at their window on the second floor or something where they're going to say, oops, you know, it's time to start taking some action. I hope that's not the case. But as you mentioned, part of the holistic view that I'm talking about is addressing the system, because someone like Al Gore, who is the face of environmentalism on the planet, isn't challenging the system. He'll just say, well, let's switch from toilet paper to recycled toilet paper. Let's switch from one type of car to a hybrid car. And these baby steps, which is essentially what they are, aren't going to solve the problem. It's been calculated that if every human being perform the changes that he suggested in the movie in Inconvenient Truth, it will result in a one-time 21% reduction in carbon emissions, while any responsible scientist is calling for 75% reduction. I applaud Al Gore for bringing outsiders into the fold. People who are not even aware of these issues can start to make these steps and feel empowered. The problem I have with him and most mainstream environmentalists is the implication that that's enough. All you got to do is look around you, and it doesn't have to be the water lapping at your window. Situation is dire, and we need to take action immediately.
A lot of the left has not dealt with these issues at all, including me. I'm just learning yet again about what it means to develop more sensitivity towards other species that we share this planet with. William Kunstler, near the end of his life, began to speak of the link between the mass slaughter of animals, capital punishment, and the history of colonization, and what we need to do to begin to change things.
Marjorie Spiegel, a neighbor of mine in Greenwich Village,
writes William Kunstler,
has written a most compelling book, The Dreaded Comparison, in which he details the devastating similarities between animal and human slavery. Alice Walker, in her most eloquent foreword, states that
the animals of the world exist for their own reasons. They were not made for humans any more than black people were made for whites or women for men.
We owe it to ourselves and the animal world as well to create not merely a body of rules and regulations to govern our conduct, but a level of sensibility that makes us care deeply and constructively about the entire planet and all of its varied inhabitants. If we can accomplish this, then perhaps in some far-off day, those who follow us down the track of the generations will be able to dwell in relative harmony with all of the creatures of the earth, human and non-human.
I'm concerned about these leftists. It was a huge fight that we had to get even the Left Forum, or Monthly Review for that matter, to talk about environmental issues until about 5 years ago. Couldn't get it onto the agenda anywhere. And that was just environmental issues. Now there are a whole lot of panels at the Left Forum. Monthly Review is now edited by John Bellamy Foster, who has written a lot about ecology and Marxism. So it seems like there's some movement within the left on certain aspects of these questions. I mean, Ward Churchill pisses me off when he says that. He also, when he called people little Eichmanns who were killed in 9/11, this idea of what it means to be a man or a human. It's like Giuliani, when we were organizing against the pesticide spraying here in New York, Giuliani would call the No Spray Coalition folks, me and a whole bunch of others, eco-terrorists for trying to stop the spraying. of pesticides everywhere. And he even said you could sniff it through a straw and nothing will happen. And then a few months later, he ended up with cancer, as did a whole number of people in his administration. I expect that from the ruling class, from those in power. But I wish it was different from the left.
I think that part of my perspective, which sways away from traditional leftism, is because I didn't go to college. I wasn't part of a lot of the traditional collectives and groups. And I guess I've always been a bit of a lone wolf. And a lot of the issues that I embrace just sort of come naturally, sort of organically. Once I began to question the company line and the corporate media line, I saw no reason to stop questioning issues. And so I could be sitting and talking to a group of quote-unquote leftists, and any one of them might believe that remote control planes flew into the World Trade Center on 9/11, or they'll have no shortage of what some people call conspiracy theories, or what would be pretty accurate. For example, in 1998, they would say, well, the only reason Clinton bombed Sudan and blew up a pharmaceutical plant was because he wanted to distract the media from Monica Lewinsky. And they have no trouble making connections like that. But if I were to say to them, I'm not sure that human beings with a functioning immune system need to have toxic vaccinations pumped into them, they would recoil in horror. And there seems to be this line that they won't cross as to their skepticism. And that includes the meat-based diet, and that includes animal cruelty to some degree. It's almost as if they've swallowed half of the American way of life, and it ends there. What's amazing, particularly for environmental issues, it's by far the most important issue. There seems to be this ignoring of this 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that perhaps these issues are too big, too depressing. I understand that, and I understand that we need to have momentum and we need to win some victories to feel like we can win more victories, but that inevitably leads to the issues we put aside never being addressed. It's encouraging that environmentalism is entering into the Left Forum and Monthly Review. I don't know what took them so long, but I don't think I could think of a more important issue than the destruction of our ecosystem. We could invoke single-payer health care tomorrow. It won't do anything for the environment. So it doesn't mean that you don't fight for single-payer, but I've never understood why the left seems to have this invisible line that they won't cross for the most part. It involves challenging our entire way of life, and that's something that I do quite often. I like to quote Barack Obama from his inauguration where he announced that we will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. Words that could have been spoken by any president from George Washington right up to now, thus proving A, there's very little difference between them, but B, proving that the changes are going to be minor at best. And I think what scares people is when you say we need to challenge the entire system, the entire culture, the thought of that is frightening. And also, it's intimidating in the sense that where do we start? And so I like to talk about the big issues, but I also like to talk about making the personal changes. And when I talk about animal cruelty and carbon emissions and vegan diet, these are changes that someone could hear this recording and make 30 seconds later. It doesn't involve having to organize a collective, put up a website, get a petition together, file for a nonprofit status. You can make a change right now. And I'm not saying it's the only change, but it's very empowering to realize that if you were to embrace a plant-based diet, that you would be challenging issues surrounding worker rights, for example, who works in sweatshops, undocumented immigrants, poor people. It's generally considered to be the most dangerous job in America. So even if you don't have a whole lot of compassion for animals, but worker rights is your issue, there it is. Corporate welfare. A pound of meat would cost something like $12 if we weren't subsidizing it. So if that outrages you, there's your in right there. If you talk about issues of torture, well, look at what's being done to animals in laboratories, on fur farms, and in slaughterhouses. If you're offended by torture, there's your in right there. And of course, 51% of human-caused greenhouse gases comes from the industrial meat-based diet. So if you're outraged by the destruction of our ecosystem, you can change your part in it today as you're listening to this. Of course, I don't want people to hear what I'm saying and think, this is too big, I can't deal with it. I want them to look at the big picture, but I also want them to realize that they can take steps immediately to be involved, and I don't see many people on the left doing it, and it's really, really unfortunate. Yeah.
mystery, the thorn, the veil, the face of grace, the brazen image, the thief of sleep, the ambassador of dreams, the prince of peace. I am the sword, the wound, the stain, scorned, transfigured child of Cain. I rend, I end, I return again. I am the salt, the bitter laugh. I am the gas in a womb of light, the evening star, the ball of sight that bleeds, that sheds the tears of Christ, dying and drying as I rise tonight.
Well, President Obama was in Afghanistan yesterday visiting the troops, got a standing ovation from the troops.
Our troops.
The troops. Should visit both sides' troops. That would be interesting. I don't know if any president has ever done that. And that reminds me when George Bush went to Iraq to visit the troops. On Thanksgiving morning in 2003, Bush showed up in Iraq before sunrise for a photo op, wearing an army workout jacket and surrounded by soldiers. At least Obama has a bit more class than that. Got to say something positive. Even though he's supporting nuclear power plants as the way of dealing with his energy situation, carbon dioxide and so forth, Bush cradled a platter. Remember that picture when he held a platter with what appeared to be a golden brown turkey on it? Washington Post reporter Mike Allen wrote that the bird looks perfect, with bunches of grapes and other trimmings, completing a Norman Rockwell image that evokes beauty and security in one of the most dangerous parts of the world, unquote. The turkey platter was a phony. It was a plastic decoration that Bush posed with for the cameras. And George Bush didn't have the platter, the artificial turkey, because he was supporting vegetarianism. I'm a little torn. On the one hand, I'm glad he didn't have a real turkey there. Since that Thanksgiving, there's a huge upsurge of childhood leukemia in Iraq and soon to be in Afghanistan as well. George Bush's America has filled the Iraqi landscape with depleted uranium armaments that have poisoned the agriculture and water supply for the next several million years. Something that Mickey Z talked about in quoting from Ward Churchill about what does it mean to be a man in that macho way, that reminds me of what happened here, where the New York Post ran a picture of one of these soldiers and captioned him the Marlboro Man, rugged, oil-smeared face dragging on a U.S. cigarette. It's not the individual soldier's fault that the media needs to invent its heroes in such caricatures, but forgive me if I look elsewhere, maybe to the guerrillas, to the hundreds of military resistors, to the immigrants rounded up for simply existing, people who are fighting against the USA Patriot Act and the decimation of the Bill of Rights, for reminding of what it means to be human in an era of robots. One additional consideration has to do with our fetishization of Thanksgiving food, and this is the tie-in to what Mickey Z was talking about. Why we eat it, where it comes from, when I think back to when I was a kid, I remember my Aunt Dora. She cooked these huge, elaborate Thanksgiving dinners, secret recipe for delicious turkey and stuffing that I enjoyed so much. And now I think about it, I'm revolted by the ritual annual slaughter of tens of millions of turkeys, which many of us feast on while watching equally sanitized images of blown-up Iraqi and Afghan children.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot-de-la-da, toot. He blows it A to the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes the company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was a boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. Plays boogie boogie bugle, he was busy as a bzzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump A to the bar. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. Do 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 da da do da da do do. He blows it A to the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. And the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. Sleep with Boogie every night and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays when someone gives him a beat. He really breaks it up when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Da, 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 da.
If you're underwater one morning, don't blame it on global warming. The hole in the sky is just a lie. Icebergs are actually forming. Pumping oil is green. That's how I want it seen. So I've changed my roles to teach your schools a corporate American dream.
Globalization, it's a pirate's life for me. We're fighting over each other for your dependency. And as long as you go to war, whenever we want you to, you'll have a tank full of petrol every morning.
I say, I say, I say. How many Indonesians does it take to make a pair of trainers? Who cares? Now the workers of the Western world are such a fussy bunch, demanding such conditions as holiday pay and lunch. So a strategy I plotted to foil the workers' plan is to shut down all their factories here and build them in Taiwan.
Globalization, it's a pirate's life for me. We're fighting over each other for your dependency. And as long as you go to war, whenever we want you to, you'll have a tank full of petrol every morning.
Free trade!
Salad all year round. The lorries come from Africa with lettuce by the pound. Our pipeline feeds the lorry and the lettuce feeds your health. And everyone is happy as I globalize myself.
Globalization, it's a pirate's life for me. We're fighting over each other for your dependency. And as long as you go to war, whenever we want you to, you'll have a tank full of petrol every morning.
To eat.
and food has gotta be cheap. So the future of food's a GM crop for me. Sure, your local farmer may be hanging, but that won't stop me banging on about how globalization's good for me. It's good for me.
It's good for me.
It's good for me.
It's good for
me. Oh yes, it's bloody well good for me.
We want for him.
Your local farmer may be hanging, but that won't stop me banging on about how globalization's good for me. We're the brokers and the dealers, the planetary peelers, the apple of our triangular
eye.
The fate of planets lie before us. Don't think you can ignore us. Just join in with my chorus or you'll die.
Globalization, it's a pirate's life for me. We're fighting over each other for your dependency. And as long as you go to war, whenever we want you to, you'll have a tank full of petrol every morning. A tank full of petrol, a tank full of petrol, a tank full of petrol every morning.
Morning.
A tank full of petrol, yeah?
Welcome back to Steal This Radio. This is Mitchell Cohen here in New York City with Mickey Z. Your latest book is Self-Defense for Radicals, A to Z Guide for Subversive Struggle. What is this about and why did you write it?
Well, it's the first chance I've had to blend two lifelong interests of mine, which would be martial arts and writing. In fact, my earliest writing was for martial arts magazines. That's where I kind of broke in. And I would say that the biggest influence of me in that area would be Bruce Lee, as cliche as that sounds, because he was far more than just the movie star. Anyone who's had a chance to read his works, he was quite a maverick. And although now just about every martial artist studies many different styles and picks what they like, this was unheard of in Bruce Lee's time. And he was the one who broke the mold. And that appealed to me on some intrinsic level as a kid. I just liked the idea that he didn't want to wear uniforms and belts and he didn't want to bow to a master. That sounded great to me. Everyone he met, he learned from and melded it into his own style. So when people ask me, who was your biggest influence as a philosopher or political thinker? My first answer is Bruce Lee. He's the one who got me started on the path of challenge. Authority.
Well, you have all sorts of quotes from Bruce Lee throughout the booklet.
It's a chance to pay homage to him. I mean, he's been such a huge influence on me, and I almost found it impossible to write about anything related to fighting where I couldn't reference him a little bit. But the book itself, which is a pamphlet actually from PM Press, is this melding of literal self-defense with metaphorical self-defense, because I didn't want to just do a literal self-defense book. There are so many out there, but I do believe, in the same way that I've been talking about this holistic perspective on global issues, that if we felt more connected to each other and to the natural world, we would be more likely to defend it, because we and the natural world are under assault 24 hours a day. So this book gave me an opportunity to touch on both aspects of self-defense, because unfortunately we do live in a violent society and it's not impossible that people will be physically attacked. And certainly a lot of the book focuses on women's self-defense, because every 46 seconds in America, a woman is raped. This is an inexcusable reality, and it's wonderful when people can fight back and women can fight back. So I wanted to give literal tools, elbows, knees, eye gouging, headbutts, reality that we can and we should fight back when the opportunity is right. But I did want to make it more metaphorical in the sense that so much of what passes for dissent today is archaic. When I do talks, I like to do a little bit in the middle where I pick someone in the crowd and pretend that I saw them lying on the floor and someone was standing over them, having knocked them down, say, with a blunt instrument, and is about to finish them off. And it's my job to step in and do something. So I start out by saying, well, being that I'm an activist, there's so many options available to me. For I could organize a candlelight vigil, I could pass around a petition, I could become the change I wish to see in the world, I could ask what would Jesus do, or I could try to remember that excellent phrase about nonviolence that I got from my Pilates teacher. And it goes on from there, and people begin to get where I'm going with it. And then I describe what it would be like if I walked over and got the big guy's attention away from my fallen friend and perhaps drew his hands and eyes down for a finger jab to the eyes. And once his hands come up, maybe a groin kick, and double him over and grab his face and bring it down on my knee. And before I finish him off, though, of course, I realize that New York state law allows for force in the manner of self-defense as long as the threat remains imminent. So I'm careful to stay within those bounds. And if I've finished him off, that's good enough. And then I ask the person, the volunteer in the audience, it's either that or chanting. What would you want me to do? And of course, everyone says, kick his ass. The point of this is that I'm not pushing violence. I'm not pushing any tactic on people. But what the book, Self-Defense for Radicals, is A to Z, and the T in the book is for toolbox. And when I say toolbox, I mean that we all in life have tools in which we use to deal with certain situations. And what's interesting about activists is they decide before the struggle which tools they're even going to bring to the battle. They decide beforehand what they're willing to do without even knowing what the terms of the struggle would be. And being that we undoubtedly are the underdogs, it takes incredible arrogance or maybe just to be naive to think that we can...
Or stupidity.
Think that we can dictate the terms of any struggle before it's even happened. So this is not a call for violence, but it's saying that let's leave all the options on the table because sometimes in a violent world, you have to defend yourself.
And one of the things that you do say in the book throughout is after you intercede physically, you try to create enough time to run away.
Absolutely.
That's really important to be able to run away and not macho it.
Yeah, this isn't about creating heroes. It's a word I strongly dislike and try not to use as much as possible. It's about doing what needs to be done in a crisis situation, not in an egotistical, macho way. This is not a book about men defending women. This is about individuals in a situation where they might need to exercise individual or global self-defense and leaving their options open, being creative, and seeing what needs to be done. Because when you're in an emergency, it's not really time to start analyzing good and bad. We have to do what's necessary to stop the bleeding and stop the situation.
Well, part of it is also to avoid or prevent getting into that situation to begin with. Yes, when you're in the situation, you have to do all sorts of things that you might not do in other parts of your life. But when we're leading up to a situation, you try to avoid it. I learned long ago when I'd be just walking down a street at night, I experience what's around me totally differently than most women that I know. If I'm walking down a street, I very rarely look around behind me. I'm in a different universe. But a lot of the women I know always look over their shoulder. And if I was walking behind a person, they'd be looking at me and thinking, maybe that guy is going to attack me. So what do I do? So I could... Usually I just drop further behind or I cross the street or something because I don't want to stress somebody out. Yeah. But it's weird to try and get out of one's own head only and try and create a more common head, a communal head.
I remember seeing a talk by the writer Derek Jensen, and I wish I could remember the exact phrase he used.
We had him on the show. We did a double show with him.
Okay. He and I did an event last year, and it was really a pleasure to work with him. And he talks about something... I may not have the exact phrase, but it's along the lines of the democracy of violence, he called it. What does that mean? He said, ask any woman in any country after dark on a quiet street, and she could explain what this common bond across the entire globe is. And the fact that you recognize that and drop back, these are amazing steps for men to take, to recognize that their sheer presence is oppressive. And therefore, a simple slowing down to send the message, you know, I'm a comrade. I'm just doing my part. I'm walking down the street. I'm tired. I had a long day. We're in this together is a powerful bond across the genders. And I wouldn't blame any woman for speeding up if I'm walking down the street behind them. I don't take it personally. This is the culture we live in. So therefore, with this book, it's to address these type of issues, is to bring them out into the open to say, this is what's happening. But then also, maybe that woman can have a little bit more awareness of her surroundings and perhaps learn to defend herself if a situation presents itself. So it's a multifaceted approach. The ultimate goal being, of course, a lot more solidarity, where we're all working together. We're not so worried about who's going to attack me. It's like, who can I work with? That would be the ultimate goal.
One of the things I experienced when I was in Cuba back in 1992, a long time ago, I was friends with Aurora, a young woman who worked there. She was a lawyer in the environmental ministry. She always carried this knife. She said that, well, there was a woman raped in her neighborhood earlier that year. I guess everything is relative in a way. If you're coming from a place where there are no rapes on the street, it's so different than here. And yet, basically.
Yeah, it doesn't have to. Again, I'm not sitting here advocating violence, and certain situations fighting back could be more dangerous than running without a doubt. I mean, getting away, avoiding a situation, talking your way out of it, running, finding more people to help you obviously is the choice over violence of any kind. But it's interesting that story, because it also points out the denial that feeds our way of life, because what anything you say about Cuba to 95% of Americans is going to be heard in a negative way. somehow they would spin that story into some type
there's
of
a rape on this,
or else block. They would just say that, you know, that nobody would dare rape because there's the communists have cameras everywhere and they control everyone's mind. They find some way to spin it as if we can't learn. There are no perfect cultures, but we can learn from every culture. And
there are all sorts of things that happen in families. We talked to women in prison who had killed their husbands for attacking them or raping them.
Just the fact that they have an environmental ministry in 1992, you know, it's just amazing. And that story illustrates a form of intellectual self-defense, that if you open up your mind and you believe that you can learn from anyone, right off the bat, you're taking a step in the right direction. And that's something that is not even common on the left. People get stuck in their individual dogma or their issues. You bring up Cuba to half the people on the left, you'll get a standing ovation. The other half, you'll be tomatoes thrown at you. Instead of just opening their mind, saying, well, there's some good, there's some bad, what can we learn? And I think you can't count out intellectual self-defense. Having an open mind, rediscovering that subversive pleasure of thinking for yourself is a great step toward self-defense.
You mentioned that you were in Catholic school for 12 years?
Yes. All the way through grade school.
I mean, I was in Hebrew school for 6 years after public school.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah, because you do all the classes in Catholic school. But when I was much younger, the nuns still had the big habits and stuff like that. And I remember when they went through that change where they suddenly wore shorter dresses, I might have been in the second or third grade, and I was astonished that they had legs and feet. It was this amazing moment for me. But I grew up in Queens in a time period where I like to look back now with some sense of nostalgia, pre-internet, pre-cable TV. We almost seem to have a provincial culture of our own in each neighborhood. Maybe you can go no more than two or three blocks and someone had a different culture. And I had cousins that lived out on Long Island, and we used to like to joke with them that they were 3 to 5 years behind us on the music. And in this day and age where everything is instantly accessible and there's sort of one homogenous culture, I think that we're losing out a little bit. Provincialism can be a bad thing, but there's nothing wrong with having a clan or a tribe. You go to school with somebody from first grade to 12th grade and you really get to know them and their family, and you know the guy who owns the store on the corner. I like to think that this type of experience growing up shaped me in an unspoken way in terms of respecting the power of community and solidarity and getting to know people and sitting on your stoop. That was our Facebook back then, sitting on the stoop and talking. I think that this encouraged me in a lot of ways. And I also was incredibly fortunate that my parents were very open-minded. They weren't open-minded perhaps politically and religiously and so on, but in terms of raising myself and my sister, they let us make our decisions, and they would tell us what they might prefer we do, but we could reach our own decisions, make our own mistakes. And I think it was a valuable lesson to me, and I've made my share of mistakes, that's for sure, but it gave me a confidence to trust my instincts. And I found that that's carried over politically, because when you're trusting your instincts, you get yourself a little bit of a bullshit detector. You start to catch on that, you know, when the two-party system or whatever it might be, you start to catch on that what they're telling you might just not be true. And it's a powerful, liberating feeling to think for yourself. And I've always been attracted to characters that did.
We're talking with Mickey Z. If you'd like to hear more or read more of his work, you can go to the website, which is at
mickeyz.net.
That's M-I-C-K-E-Y-Z. Z, the letter Z.net.
Yep.
I've seen some of your op-eds in various local newspapers around New York, in the Metro.
Sometimes when you write about such a broad range of topics as I do, you can kind of finagle your way into some mainstream venues. I also write for Planet Green, which is a mainstream environmental site, and I like to think I play an important role there in balancing out the smaller steps that people could take with maybe a bigger picture of environmentalism. And Metro, I mean, one of the great experiences I ever had with Metro is they used to print a picture of me too, is being on this crowded morning subway where you're holding on to the straps and you're bouncing back and forth, and I look over someone's shoulder and they're reading my op-ed. And there was this moment for a second, you're like, hey, this is what Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin once felt like. Overflattering myself for sure, but it was certainly a real kick. So it was a lot of fun writing for Metro.
Well, having read a bit of Mickey Z's stuff, I think he's right on par with Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill.
Thank you.
Excellent writing. So you could read more again of Mickey Z at mickeyz.net. Please tune in again next week when we'll be back with Steal This Radio. Thanks, Mickey.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. From Colorado, Kansas, and the Carolinas too, Virginia and Alaska, from the old to the new, Texas and Ohio and the California shore. Tell me who could ask for more? Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. Yet she's only as rich as the poorest of the poor, only as free as a padlocked prison door, only as strong as our love for this land, only as tall as we stand. For here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all, on us all.